Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. is sending aid to France to fight West African terrorists, and a second Nigerian nurse contracts Ebola. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama has authorized $10 million in military aid to help France fight terrorists in the Sahel region of West Africa. From his vacation retreat along the Atlantic Ocean, Mr. Obama said today that an unforeseen emergency exists requiring the assistance for France as it fights against violent extremists in Mali, Niger, and Chad. The funds will be used for airlift and aerial refueling services requested by France. Nigerian officials said today that one new Ebola case was diagnosed over the weekend. Nigeria now has 10 confirmed cases, and 177 people are being monitored for signs of the disease. Heather Murdoch reports.
Since a Liberian-American financial consultant flew into Lagos from Liberia about 3 weeks ago, the number of new cases has slowly grown, increasing the number of people that may have been exposed. Over the weekend, another patient was diagnosed in apparent connection with the Liberian-American man, says Nigerian Minister of Health, Onabuchi Chukwu. Ebola has killed nearly 1,000 people since the outbreak began early this year, with all but two deaths in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Two members of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch say Egypt has barred them for entering the country ahead of a report critical of the killings by security forces last year. The group's officials, Executive Director Kenneth Roth and his Middle Eastern Director Sara Lee Whitson, said today Egyptian authorities held them overnight at a Cairo airport before denying them entry for security reasons. The rights activists had flown to Egypt for a release of the report, marking a year since at least 1,100 protesters were killed demonstrating against the army's overthrow of the Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. NATO Secretary General says the alliance has seen no sign of Russian forces pulling back from the border with Ukraine and that there is a high probability that Moscow will intervene militarily in eastern Ukraine. We see the Russians developing the narrative and the pretext for such an operation under the guise of a humanitarian operation, and we see a buildup that could be used to conduct such illegal military operations in Ukraine. Anders Fogh Rasmussen spoke to the Reuters news agency. Meanwhile, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman said today that Russia will send humanitarian aid into eastern Ukraine if we can agree all details with the partners. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian military says troops are continuing to close in on remaining separatist regions in the east and are warning civilians to evacuate the areas. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
Ukrainian military spokesman Andrei Lysenko told reporters in Kiev Monday that anti-terror forces are attacking separatist strongholds from four directions, closing in on the main rebel-held town of Donetsk. Lysenko warned civilians to leave the areas around Donetsk and neighboring Luhansk province near the border with Russia to avoid the coming assault. He added that the armed forces will do what it can to provide transportation for citizens wishing to flee. The United Nations says more than 100,000 people have been internally displaced from the two eastern regions in Ukraine since the conflict began in May. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kiev.
Iraqi President Fuad Masum has asked the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Haider Abadi, to form a new government as the country faces the onslaught of Islamic State militants who have overrun much of its northern and western parts with little opposition from outmanned Iraqi forces. Abadi was nominated today for the post by Iraq's main Shiite bloc, the National Alliance. Israel and the Palestinians, meanwhile, have started new talks in Cairo aimed at crafting a permanent truce to end fighting in Gaza. The latest three-day Israeli-Palestinian ceasefire held today as Egypt mediated indirect talks between the warring sides after a month-long conflict that has left more than 2,000 people dead. As the negotiators met, Gaza shops and businesses reopened, and residents who had been staying in shelters returned to their homes. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigerian officials said Monday one new Ebola case was diagnosed over the weekend, widening the circle of people that have come into contact with the disease. Nigeria now has had 10 confirmed cases and 177 people known to have had contact with sick patients are being monitored for signs of the disease.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also in the news, interim Central African Republic President Catherine Samba Panza has named a Muslim politician as prime minister, and a UN official says Somalia faces a second famine in 3 years unless donors increase funding.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nigeria, along with Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, have been scrambling to contain the Ebola virus, but weak medical and sanitation infrastructures present challenges. Guinea announced Saturday it is closing its borders with Liberia and Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization has declared the epidemic an international health emergency. WHO Chief Dr. Margaret Chan says the four nations do not have the capacity to manage an outbreak of this size and complexity and appealed for greater international aid. The current Ebola outbreak in West Africa is on pace to infect more people than all previous outbreaks of the virus combined. The disease has no known cure or vaccine. WHO said last week the number of Ebola cases in the four affected West African countries was 1,779 and that 961 of those people have already died. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has activated its Emergency Operations Center at the highest level. CDC Chief Dr. Thomas Frieden says his agency will soon have 50 disease experts in West Africa. Ebola patients may experience fever, vomiting, diarrhea, body aches, and uncontrollable bleeding from all openings in the body, including the eyes, mouth, and ears. Initial symptoms are often similar to malaria.
Nigerian officials said today one new Ebola case was diagnosed over the weekend, widening the circle of people that have come into contact with the disease. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja that Nigeria now has had 10 confirmed cases and 177 people known to have had contact with sick patients are being monitored for signs of the disease.
Every time an Ebola case is diagnosed, the containment clock is reset. If no one that came into contact with the sick person gets sick within 21 days, chances are no one will. Since a Liberian-American financial consultant flew into Lagos from Liberia about 3 weeks ago, the number of new cases has slowly grown, increasing the number of people that may have been exposed. Over the weekend, another patient was diagnosed in apparent connection with the Liberian-American man, says Nigerian Minister of Health, Onabuchi Chukwu.
It was one of the nurses who had primary contact, and when he got here, we then brought her into isolation, and we just tested her over the weekend, and she tested positive.
Ebola has killed nearly 1,000 people since the outbreak began early this year, with all but two deaths in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Reports that experimental drugs have appeared to have been successful in treating American and European health workers and missionaries that contracted the disease in West Africa have prompted many Nigerians to demand access to the drugs in case it spreads further. Minister Chukwu.
Nigeria is actually, as of now, reaching out to various laboratories, various governments, including the U.S. state governments, to see how some of these untried but drugs and vaccines that seem to hold out some hope could also be deployed in Nigeria. We are in touch.
The World Health Organization says it expects a vaccine to be developed by 2015, but currently there is no known cure. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan Friday pledged $11.7 million to try to stop the spread in Nigeria and $3.5 million to help other countries fight off the disease. Meanwhile, Nigerian officials continue a massive communications campaign to squash the equally massive rumor mill. Local news reports illnesses all over the country from people drinking too much salt water or eating too much of certain fruits, falsely believing it will prevent Ebola. Officials speak publicly daily about how to keep from getting Ebola, which is transmitted through contact with bodily fluids like blood, urine, or sweat. It cannot be transmitted through air, the minister says, but
if you are in close contact and someone who is suffering from it is sneezing or coughing into your face, you could also get it because the droplets will touch you. So that close contact makes it, you know, why that's why some people say it's not airborne, that you need that close contact.
He urges people to wash their hands frequently, especially after touching another person, and says so far in Nigeria, the disease has not spread out of Lagos, a megacity of 21 million people, which is often called the heartbeat of the Nigerian economy. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Thank you, Heather. Malawi health authorities say they are taking measures to prevent the spread of the Ebola virus into the country with airport screenings of international passengers. But critics say this is not enough. Medical workers need urgent training on how to handle an infected person, specialized equipment is needed, and public education efforts must be stepped up. Lamek Messina has more from Blantyre.
Minister of Health authorities say the airport screenings are currently done to those passengers from West African countries most hit by Ebola virus, Guinea, Liberia, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone. The government has also set up quarantine centers at the country's two airports, Kamuzu International Airport in the capital, Lilongwe, and Chilega Airport in the commercial capital, Blantyre, for those who may have contracted the virus. Charles Mwansambo is the Director of Health Services in the Ministry of Health. He told journalists in Lilongwe that there is no need for Malawians to panic because chances for them getting infected are minimal.
I need to reassure members of the public not to panic because Ebola is spread by direct contact with bodily fluids. And bodily fluids here, we're talking about blood, talking about saliva, we're talking about urine. And the chances of Malawians going to West Africa and getting in touch with these bodily fluids are very minimal.
But the chairperson of Malawi's Parliamentary Committee on Health, Juliana Lunguzi, told VOA that what Mwansambo said is unrealistic. She said there is no logic in telling people not to panic when the situation on the ground shows that the government is doing nothing to prevent the outbreak.
To say, don't panic, anything can happen. And people go to places like Nigeria, especially to TB Joshua, where they are looking for healing, and here Ebola is one of the diseases. So we are saying, we'd rather panic. Let a certain group be panicking right now by giving us a response that somebody is putting something together so that you can even see the redness somewhere.
She says the message contained in the only press release the government has so far issued on Ebola virus does not benefit many Malawians because it's in English, a language many Malawians do not understand. Lunguzi, who is a nurse by profession, said her committee will soon summon government authorities to explain their readiness in terms of medical equipment for combating the possible spread of Ebola into the country.
We know our hospitals are already have a serious short supply of equipment and supplies. Currently, we are yet to hear if there's anything. We have called several hospitals. Everybody says this, we don't have equipment, anything ready in readiness for the Ebola. So we want to make sure that we meet and let the government tell us exactly what they have done.
Jonathan Gama is the chairperson for Human Resources for Health, a coalition of health professionals in Malawi. He says Malawi is not in any way ready to contain the virus. Gama says inadequate medical equipment, protective wear, and orientation for health workers as among the signs of the country's unpreparedness.
What we are suggesting that there should be capacity building of the health workers. The health workers should be trained. And after training the health workers, they should also procurement of resources as Ebola demands. So that when Ebola instances appear in Malawi, we should not be taken by surprise.
But Minister of Health officials insist that something's being done to prevent the spread of the virus. Its spokesperson, Henry Chimbali, told reporters the ministry is working on a budget that would fund efforts to contain the deadly disease. The World Health Organization says the virus is a global health problem. To contain the spread, some African countries, including Guinea and Zambia, have closed their borders with Western African countries hardest hit by the Ebola virus. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Interim Central African Republic President Catherine Samba Panza has named a Muslim politician to lead the nation, which has been torn by sectarian violence. Mrs. Samba Panza's office announced the appointment of 53-year-old Mahamat Kamoun as Prime Minister to replace Andre Zapiaki. The change followed a ceasefire agreement between two warring factions, Seleka rebels and anti-Balakas, during meetings in Congo Brazzaville late last month. Observers hope that Samba Panza, a Christian and the former mayor of the capital city, and Kamoun, a government technocrat, will enforce the fragile ceasefire and lead the interim government to peaceful reconstruction and popular elections.
A UN official says Somalia faces a second famine in 3 years unless donors increase funding to avoid further food shortages. Felipe Lazzarini, the UN humanitarian coordinator for Somalia, says that rapidly rising malnutrition, increasing food shortages, and the effects of conflict threaten the lives of thousands. About 260,000 Somalis died in the 2011 famine. African Union forces are trying to recover portions of the nation that remain under the control of the Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab. President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud said last week that 22,000 troops of AMISOM are planning to renew their offensive as the rainy season ends this month. With competition for aid funding for other conflict areas such as South Sudan, Ukraine, and Syria, the UN was able to raise only a third of the $933 million needed in Somalia this year. International donors promised $2.5 billion in reconstruction aid at a Brussels conference last September. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The total number of people with the Ebola virus in Nigeria has now reached 10. Interim Central African Republic President Catherine Samba Panza has named a Muslim politician as prime minister. And a UN official says Somalia faces a second famine in 3 years unless donors increase funding. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
African leaders have unanimously agreed to end hunger and cut poverty in half by 2025. The agreement came during today's African Union meeting in Addis Ababa with the signing of the Malabo Declaration. The declaration calls for greater investment in agriculture to achieve food and nutrition security, as well as shared prosperity. African leaders also agreed to build resilience to climate change. AU Chairperson Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma said accelerated growth is essential if Africans are to achieve their aspiration for prosperity. The AU calls agriculture the solution to long-term social and economic development issues.
A new report says a lot of young people are leaving Eritrea due to authoritarian rule, growing dissatisfaction and long-term national service. The International Crisis Group calls for both domestic and international action to reduce the youth drain. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
Many young Africans are leaving the continent, hoping to find jobs and opportunities elsewhere. But the International Crisis Group says the youth exodus from Eritrea is acute. It says the Eritrean government's demand to sacrifice individual ambition for the greater good of the nation is causing people to leave. Dr. Kedrick Barnes is the ICG's Horn of Africa project director.
The primary driver at the moment seems to be because people are fed up with the national service, where people are required to either join the army or work for the government in various capacities for very little money and with no prospect of being released. We are seeing people voting with their feet, as it were, to avoid these demands.
Barnes says many risk their lives doing so.
Well, that's clear that that's happening at various stages of the journey, even at the end stages in terms of the overloaded boats that seem to be arriving on the southern shores of Europe, especially Malta and Italy, where boats are overloaded and these vessels are sinking, often drowning many of their occupants.
But their lives are in danger even before they get on the boats. They have to travel through lawless and dangerous parts of Sudan and Libya, for example. And Barnes says for a time, Eritrean forces prevented border crossings by lethal force if necessary. Initially, the government tried to crack down on the migration. Then, Barnes says, it saw an economic opportunity through remittances and a 2% tax imposed on the migrants. But Barnes says that's not forestalling long-term issues.
They're losing their working population. They are losing the relatively scarce human capital that Eritrea has. This is affecting from the army to the national services, as well as families, especially the farm and other productive activities that need man and woman power.
The International Crisis Group recommends that Eritrea reset its relationship with the outside world by becoming more engaged diplomatically. It also recommends that Eritrea gradually demobilize its national service and ease border tensions with Ethiopia.
The kind of isolationist position that Eritrea has found itself in is preventing a society where people's individual social and economic freedoms can be pursued, which is encouraging people to leave and look for better alternatives.
The ICG also says Eritrea should seek assistance from the European Union and the UN to help restructure the country's economy to create more jobs for young people. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on 23 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is stepping up efforts to contain the spread of the liver disease, hepatitis E, among South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. The agency says that hepatitis E has been spreading across South Sudan over the last 2 years. It has now appeared in three border camps that house some 150,000 South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. Ariane Romery is a UNHCR spokesperson. She explained the camps are located in the Gambela region of western Ethiopia, bordering South Sudan.
It's existing in three refugee camps, actually in Ethiopia, but on the border with South Sudan, housing about 150,000 Sudanese refugees. This is related to the outbreak of hepatitis E in South Sudan itself. And what we're seeing now is it's also been an epidemic in the Ethiopian side, though fortunately, as a result of interventions of ourselves and our partners, that is now in decline.
What causes hepatitis E and how does it spread?
Hepatitis E is caused by a virus, and it's mainly spread by consuming contaminated water and food. And that's why we've been working to improve sanitation camps and increase the availability of safe drinking water. But we've also been working really hard with the refugee community leaders to educate people about keeping their hands clean, about using latrines instead of going to the toilet in the open, and distributing soap.
How many cases have been reported so far?
We've had about 367 cases of hepatitis E in the three camps, Lutjolkul and Tirkidide camp, which are in the Gambela region of western Ethiopia. There's also six cases reported among the refugee hosting communities of Itat and Ninyang.
How does hepatitis E affect people at various age levels? For instance, a teenager compared to an adult, and also how does it affect pregnant women?
It's very sad that hepatitis E in particular affects people, young people, and ages between 15 and 40 are hit hardest. And in the three camps where we've actually seen refugees with hepatitis E, a majority of those are young people. And the virus is also really affecting. It was very dangerous for pregnant women. For pregnant women, 20 to 25% of them who contract the disease could die. And unfortunately, among the 13 refugees who did die, there was one pregnant woman.
What is involved in treating hepatitis E?
It is treatable. That's one of the things that we're emphasizing to the refugees who call the disease yellow eyes. And we're saying if you have yellow eyes, then please go to the clinic because you can get early medical treatment and that can help make you better and stem the actual spread of the disease.
Do you all have enough supply of the drugs on hand for everyone?
We do at the moment. UNHCR has been stockpiling the medicine and medical supplies in the area, as well as carrying out the building of more latrines and doing the education initiatives. So at this stage, we do have enough supplies in the area, and that's why we've been able to see a decline in the infections alongside some of the other preventative measures we've been doing.
What type of support are you all receiving in trying to contain hepatitis E?
One of the most important things is for refugees to keep their hands clean. And some of our partners, for example, Médecins Sans Frontières, has been distributing 80,000 bars of soap to encourage better hygiene. UNHCR and its partners working in the sanitation area of the camps have also been building more latrines. And of course, we've been working with the Ethiopian government and other partners in the health sector to actually treat the instances of it when it comes up.
What is your concern of the continued spread of hepatitis E?
Well, actually, this disease is already spreading in South Sudan. And in fact, the laboratory tests have confirmed that the diseases we're seeing in the camps of South Sudanese refugees is related to what's actually going on in South Sudan. So that's really where the problem has been first. And what's happening is that refugees also bringing it with them and then spreading it among each other in the camps.
That was UNHCR spokesperson Ariane Romery. She spoke with me from Geneva.
Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says he and a colleague were detained by Egyptian security forces for almost 12 hours at Cairo Airport. He says they were then denied entry into the country. Roth described his experience on Twitter today. Airport authorities said they were denied entry to the country on orders from unnamed security officials. Roth and Sarah Lee Whitson, the rights group's North Africa director, flew to Cairo today. They were to attend an event tomorrow commemorating the deaths of more than 600 demonstrators who had protested last year against the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi. Human Rights Watch had planned to release a lengthy account of its year-long investigation of the deaths. It submitted advance copies of the report to the Egyptian government, but received no response. One of the events had been called the worst massacre in modern Egyptian history. HRW said it will release the statement tomorrow from another location. This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers. Cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The total number of people with the Ebola virus in Nigeria has now reached 10. Interim Central African Republic President Catherine Samba Panza has named a Muslim politician as prime minister. And a UN official says Somalia faces a second famine in 3 years unless donors increase funding. Coming up, we have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, the role of modern African chiefs as spiritual, administrative, and judicial leaders. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand two football stars top your sports report this evening.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to star strikers Didier Drogba of Ivory Coast and Miroslav Klose of Germany, who both announced their retirements from international football. Drogba and Klose are both 36 years old, and they played 12 and 13 years, respectively, for the national teams of Ivory Coast and Germany. The two men also competed at the recent World Cup in Brazil, where Klose capped a record-breaking career by lifting the trophy. Klose scored twice in Brazil to become the World Cup's all-time record goal scorer with 16 goals. In a statement released Monday by the German Football Association, Klose said the time was right to end his career with the German national team. He said, and I quote, "Winning the title in Brazil was a childhood dream come true. I am happy and proud to have contributed to this big success for German football. For me, there could be no better moment to complete the national team chapter." Klose closes his book with the national team as Germany's all-time top scorer with 71 goals. He played in 4 World Cups and scored at each of them. Only 2 other players in history, fellow German Uwe Seeler and Brazilian great Pelé, have scored at 4 World Cups. With more details on Didier Drogba's retirement, here's the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi.
Good evening, Africa. Ivory Coast striker Didier Drogba announced his international retirement after scoring 61 goals in 103 appearances for his country. The Chelsea forward played for his country's national team, nicknamed the Elephants, for 12 years, playing in 3 World Cups and twice helping the team to finish runner-up at the Africa Cup of Nations. Drogba, who was brought up in France, won his first cap against South Africa in 2002. He played in 8 international tournaments, but never as part of a winning team. During the last 18 months, Drogba's talismanic role in the national team has been reduced by the decision of coach Sabri Lamouchi, with whom he had a strained relationship, to bench him for key matches and leave him out of others. Drogba's decision came just days after the Ivorians appointed Frenchman Avi Reynard as their new coach. "I cannot convey enough thanks to the fans for all the love and support during these years. All my goals, all my caps, all our victories are for you. I love you," Drogba said. This is wishing Didier Drogba good luck in his future endeavors.
The Voice of America, VOA.
A team of inspectors from African soccer's governing body, CAF, is in Zambia to assess the country's potentials as a future host of the Africa Cup of Nations. The five-member team arrived in Zambia on Saturday. It will visit stadiums in the capital city of Lusaka and four other cities, Chingula, Chililabumbwe, Livingstone, and Ndola. Zambia has constructed new stadiums in both Lusaka and Ndola with a capacity of some 60,000 each. The CAF team will also inspect training pitches, hotels, hospitals, as well as transport and communication networks. Zambia is among the five countries bidding to host the Nations Cup in 2019 and 2021. The team has also visited Guinea, Ivory Coast, Algeria, and Cameroon. Last week, the Democratic Republic of Congo withdrew its bid. The future hosts will be picked by CAF next month. The next Africa Cup of Nations will be staged in Morocco in early 2015, followed by Libya in 2017. And MC Alger beat rival USM Alger on Saturday to win the 2014 edition of the Algeria Super Cup. Midfielder Sid Ahmed Awaj scored the only goal of the tournament in the 88th minute at the Mustapha Chica Stadium in Blida, located southwest of the capital, Algiers. The tournament is played between the winners of the Algerian Professional League One and the Algerian Cup. This is the third time the capital-based club has won the title, after 2006 and 2007. Thanks a lot for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
It's time now on the Voice of America for David Legg's latest African football quiz question. We have a September 1st deadline to get your entries in, and the first five people to send correct answers to David will be the winners. Once again, September 1st deadline. And now David will give us his latest African football quiz question.
Thanks, Sonny. My question is, which coach has won the most CAF club titles and how many titles has he won? Just a reminder, there are five competitions involved in this. There's the CAF Champions League, and of course, in its previous life, it was known as the CAF Champions Cup. So we're going right back to 1964 with that one. And then you have the CAF Confederation Cup, which started in 2004. And you've got the CAF Super Cup, which started in 1993. And then we're also going to take into account the two competitions that preceded the CAF Confederation Cup. They were the CAF Cup, which stopped in 2003, and also the African Cup Winners' Cup. So altogether, you've got five competitions to consider in coming to your answer. Just to quickly repeat them, CAF Champions League, CAF Confederation Cup, CAF Super Cup. They're the three competitions that are present-day running competitions within Africa. And then two competitions that are now defunct, the CAF Cup and the African Cup Winners Cup. So once again, the question, which coach has won the most CAF club titles? And this is important, how many titles has he won? How many titles between those five competitions did the top coach win? Best of luck to all our listeners.
Once again, we do have a September 1st deadline, and the first five people to send correct answers to David will be our winners for this latest African football quiz question. At stake, some of those delightful Voice of America goodies. And now David and I will give our addresses out where you can send your entries.
VOA!
It's david.legg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
Voice of America.
You can send me email at sonny@voanews.com. Sonny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Voice of America.
Now let's go to Marrakesh, Morocco, where it's the second day of competition at the African Championships in athletics. The first medals were awarded on Sunday. And let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Eritrea's Negusi Emlosum, who won the gold medal in the men's 10,000 meters final. Negusi had a winning time of 28 minutes, 11.7 seconds in Marrakesh. Local favorite Mustafa El-Aziz of Morocco won the silver medal in the race, while Kenya's Josephat Bett won the bronze. In the men's shot put final, South African athletes Orazio Cremona and Jaco Engelbrecht won the gold and silver medals, respectively, while Frank Alemba from Congo Brazzaville won the bronze. Orazio Cremona had a gold medal winning distance of 19.84 meters, while the Confederation of African Athletics, which is overseeing the competition in Marrakesh, says Alemba's bronze in the shot put was Congo Brazzaville's first medal at the African Championships in a decade. In women's events in Marrakesh, Letitia Bambara of Burkina Faso was crowned African champion in the hammer throw. She had a gold medal winning distance of 65.44 meters. Amy Sene of Senegal won the silver medal, while Sarah Ben Saad from Tunisia won the bronze. Kenya's Julius Yego is defending his African title in the javelin this week in Marrakesh. Julius is the subject of my latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post, which you can read by going to voanews.com and then scrolling down to blogs at VOA News on the right side of the page. Julius was recently crowned Commonwealth Games champion in the javelin in Glasgow, Scotland. In the process, Julius became the first Kenyan to capture Commonwealth laurels in the javelin event. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. And my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page today, Monday, you'll see a photo of South African athlete Orazio Cremona, the newly crowned African champion in the shot put. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in our feature segment, the role of modern African chiefs as spiritual, administrative, and judicial leaders. And next, in Kenya, the Maasai community embracing a new water harvesting technology with marked results. But first, some music. Here is Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Used to cruise me around in your car, but thank God I got my own home. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. So why you the envy? Used to pay my bills before, but now I they pay for two. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. Brother man, still the envy. Unya yanka, that they be allowed in it, sa pete ni bola. But man no be God, man no be God. Stop all the hating. Lie, lie,
man, just be man, so you never know why. My destiny changing, I'm living so high. Make you no envy my sign, because where they bless me. Go shots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Go shots. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. The DJs, they blame my song. The fellas, they loving, they hailing my song. The ladies, they dancing, they using my song for their ringtone. You never thought about that. No man's there on top forever. Whether you short or you tall, rich or you poor, time keep changing for better. And you can't do nothing about it. Another man rain or fight. Because you know be God. And you never saw be past God. Cause that one is no one on yabala man. It does it when it feels just right. It don't just say it's never my type. So make you know they look down on another brother man. Let go. Go shots. One man down. On to the next one, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots, one man down, oh yeah, no gaba.
Said I would shrivel, said I'd be dead if I ever tried to whistle. But hey, who said it was simple? The feds take your bread so you wouldn't make a nickel. You mean I couldn't pick a pickle? Pick words when I could have picked a pistol.
Jewel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Well, princes and kings once ruled African kingdoms. Today, they survive as traditional leaders of small villages and a few larger regions. Their role is much reduced from those vast kingdoms, but royal families continue to name their sons as heirs. Their job is to connect the people to their ancestors and to the land, says Cyprian Fisi, a former director of social development at the World Bank. But for the most part, the chiefs try to stay out of politics. Fisi talked to VOA's William Eagle about the role of modern chiefs as spiritual, administrative, and judicial leaders.
Dr. Cyprian Fisi is a former director of social development at the World Bank. Fisi has studied the social and political structures of traditional chieftaincies in West Africa. He talked to VOA about how modern chiefs serve as spiritual, administrative, and judicial leaders.
Because they claim continuity with the past and linked to the ancestors, they were therefore, in essence, ordained and authorized by the ancestors, by the deities of their lands. So in that process, they became very powerful administrative leaders with regulatory powers.
Some of the great hierarchies of traditional rule were found in northern Nigeria, where Islamic caliphates dominated the politics of the region.
But most of the kingdoms I'm talking about are those who are very hierarchical, like the caliphates and so on, where they might have a span of control of more than 100,000 people or more, depending on their area of control. Yeah, especially in those areas in northern Nigeria and elsewhere, where you had the strong influence of Islam. They had very strong caliphates, and these caliphates had also a religious mandate based on Islamic teachings, and they used that also to conquer and try to subjugate those who were, as they saw them, enemies, as they called them in those days. So you find the same type of continuity right going over to the Middle East. But the recent events in Nigeria and the whole of that area in the Sahel tells you that you had very strong caliphates and with very strong military and religious leaders. And those functions are always fused into one. They're trying to base it on religious principles, which I'm not going to opine on, but I know that from their own standing, they got their basis both from their cultures and traditions as well as from Islamic teachings, which will have a real impact on the way they want to interpret and their own understanding of the Quran. But Bay Manda was always culturally constructed because it was based on a cultural frame of reference going forward.
For traditional chiefs, the question is, what's their role in a modern Africa where the nation-state is mandated to provide criminal justice, electric light, safe roads to market, and the protection of a national army? Dr. Fisi lists their responsibilities.
First, there's a very strong judicial content to their functions. So they tend to hold court and then they hold and small claims courts and things of that nature. People believe that if you had something to do, it's easier resolved at the chieftaincy level. and that those who go through traditional systems have a very strange, have a very profound understanding of the truth because it's linked to their ritual practices and to the voice of the ancestors. So in things like civil law, marriage issues, and so on, the chiefs play a very powerful role in trying to regulate those. Where they don't have powers whatsoever is in criminal matters. They are not allowed to adjudicate criminal matters because that writ has been taken by the modern state and state institutions.
It's seldom that a chief becomes a national leader these days. Fisi says the last one he can recall is Abu Bakr Tafar Balewa, the first prime minister of independent Nigeria. That was 54 years ago. Chiefs are not chosen in popular elections, but there is an element of democracy in Africa's system of traditional chiefs, says Fisi.
That is a tricky question because the way they are selected tends to be very hereditary, so it tends to be within a given family or within their... So even though you might be the wealthiest and strongest person in the community, you do not automatically become the chief in those areas which those institutions have a long ancestry. So there, the process, you may not call it democratic, but it's accountable. And the accountability mechanism is not based on the selection criteria, but how you govern your people. You may find those areas where the chieftaincy structure was not very well developed, especially in the coastal areas. And in those areas, those chiefs tend to be elected by the village community, and they may be much more democratic. They don't carry the same level of authority as those who are hereditary, because these ones get their writ from the government as such, while the others who come from hereditary systems get their writ from their traditional structures and from the ancestors of their land.
That was reporter Bill Eagle speaking with Dr. Cyprian Fisi, and tomorrow we'll hear what happened when a Rasta man became chief of a Blantyre suburb.
The Maasai of Kenya are known for their cattle herding economy and nomadic lifestyle. But that life depends on access to adequate water for their herds and flocks. In the village of Kisirian, the Maasai community is embracing a new piece of water harvesting technology with marked results. As Lenny Ruvga reports, it's called a fog collector.
Early morning in Kisirian, a town 30 kilometers from Nairobi. The Lotuno family go about their daily chores with their matriarch Hannah checking on the health of her flock.
I wake up as early as 5 a.m. to tend to the cattle before they're taken out to pasture. I then check on the sheep's health and I tend to the sickly ones. For them to be productive, they need lots of water.
Kisirian is dominated by Maasai cattle herders. During dry spells, they must go far to find enough water and pasture for their animals. Anthony Perkay is a community organizer who says lack of water is a major issue.
We experience a lot of problems because we depend on livestock in our livelihood. So when this drought, our cattle die as a result of this no water. And this area where we live is Kajiado County. We experience a lot of drought during the year as a result of climate change.
But the problem now has a solution, the fog catcher. Professor Bansi Mati from the Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology developed her variation of the device last year. The fog collectors look like tall volleyball nets slung between two poles, but they are made of a polypropylene or polyethylene mesh that is especially efficient at capturing water droplets. When the fog rolls in, the tiny droplets of water cling to the mesh, and as more and more cluster together, they drip into a gutter below that channels the water to a water tank.
Fog is water, but very few people treat it as water because fog is a cloud that is touching the ground and it's more droplets of water. The need to collect fog is because fog season follows the rainy season. So the fog season, that water, instead of letting it go to waste, it is possible to do equipment which will collect fog. And the good news is that same equipment collects rainwater quite well.
Daniel Lotuno's fog collector was installed on his homestead in April. He says he does not regret spending the $850 for it.
When there is fog or some rain, there are some water that we collect. Definitely this shows that we get some water. Because when it was raining or there is fog, we still have to go to our fetching areas. But now, since there is a fog collection, then we have water.
And for the Lotunos and other Kisarian families, that water captured by this revolutionary device is making a major impact on daily life. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Kisarian, Kenya.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrius Regis, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With nations in West Africa facing the biggest and most complex outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever in history, the United States is stepping up assistance to confront the disease. An additional 50 U.S. disease control specialists will soon travel to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the nations at the center of the epidemic, to provide technical assistance and help health officials there with emergency operations. They will also help bolster medical laboratories in the region that test for the disease and help screen air travelers to identify passengers who may have been infected. Top U.S. health officials discussed further aid with leaders from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria, who are attending the U.S. African Leaders Summit in Washington this week. Medical supplies and expertise are badly needed to combat a disease that has killed at least 900 people and infected more than 1,700, African officials say. There is no known cure for Ebola, which is spread through contact with bodily fluids and causes symptoms including fever, headaches, vomiting, and diarrhea, and can lead to internal bleeding. Supportive care, such as replacing lost fluids and administering drugs, can improve a patient's chances of survival. Two Americans who contracted Ebola while working in a clinic in Liberia are receiving experimental antibody treatments after medical evacuation to the U.S. If further testing proves the antibodies effective, they may offer hope against future cases of the disease in Africa. But they are unlikely to be ready for widespread use in the current outbreak, medical experts say. U.S. health agencies responded quickly to requests from West Africa when the scope of the problem was known. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention coordinated testing of samples from suspected cases of Ebola infection. The U.S. Agency for International Development is funding a mobile laboratory in Guinea that can quickly do tests in suspected cases of the disease. Under another USAID grant, protective equipment is being provided to healthcare workers treating the sick. Monies have been provided to fund a public information campaign to help people protect themselves from infection. Such health crises threaten us all and require a wide-ranging international response. As seen in efforts on other health threats such as HIV, AIDS, and malaria, the United States is helping lead the way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.